Hello there, this is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, and on behalf of the entire team, we hope you enjoy the program. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. You know, in the movies, it's easy to be tough on terrorists and never negotiate. But as President of the United States, it's not so easy to make a hard and fast rule and stick to it.
I believe it is high time that the civilized countries of the world made it plain that there is no room worldwide for terrorism. There will be no negotiation with terrorists of any kind.
The United States does not negotiate with terrorists, says candidate Ronald Reagan in a presidential debate just before his victory over Jimmy Carter back in 1980. Did President Reagan deliver on that pledge once he was in office? That conversation coming up. We will also explore unrest below the radar in China, the politics of Ebola in Liberia, and Matthew Weiner, the creator of Mad Men and writer on The Sopranos, explores a different kind of nostalgia in his new movie. That's later this hour. But we begin with the circumstances of James Foley's 2 years as a hostage before he was barbarically murdered by ISIS. The U.S. government has conceded that there were both military efforts underway to release Foley, a rescue mission ultimately failed, and there was an offer by ISIS to trade Foley for a large sum of money. The U.S. government claims that such a deal was never an option under U.S. policy. Here's the Treasury Department's official line on the question of cash for hostages. We make no concessions to individuals or groups holding our citizens hostage. The U.S. government condemns hostage taking under all circumstances and would caution that ransom payments made to any hostage taker risk encouraging future instances of kidnapping for ransom. Can a blanket policy be made for all hostage situations, or is each case different? Gary Sick is senior research scholar at Columbia University who was in the thick of a hostage negotiation 30 years ago during the crisis in Iran. Sick says in that case, the scale of the hostage event consumed the Carter administration and forced them to try and make a deal. Gary Sick, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's a real pleasure.
So your long sort of historical view here really tells the story of how the U.S. has not necessarily been always on the same page regarding negotiations for hostages. First of all, remind us of the Iranian situation that you participated in directly.
The Iranians took the whole U.S. embassy hostage and held it for 444 days, give or take a few people here and there. And the Carter administration attempted to negotiate with Iran to get the hostages free. And ultimately, the negotiations with Iran ended up in an agreement, a formal agreement, and the release of the hostages. Ronald Reagan came in highly critical of the way Carter had handled the hostage affair, made a formal statement right off the bat saying he was never going to negotiate with terrorists under any circumstances. And then a few years later, he actually went Carter one better. He actually traded arms for hostages in the Iran-Contra affair. The one thing you can say about hostage situations is that there really are no rules. It depends on the president, who often takes these things very, very personally. He's a human being and reacts as a human being. He feels sorry for the people that are there and often feels that he'll break whatever rules are necessary if he thinks he can make some progress.
And in the case of the Iranian hostages, there were all these propaganda films of the hostages in blindfolds that were meant to scare Americans and make them all sort of personally invested in the release of folks in Iran. It seems to me that the beheading tape of Mr. Foley also serves that same purpose, to try to get everyone invested in the release and make negotiations more likely in a psychological way.
The reality is that they do want to frighten people, and the beheading video is clearly intended to intimidate the American public and perhaps to intimidate the president, and to scare them into backing away from ISIS and saying we're not going to mess with these guys. I think that was a real mistake on their part. I think the brutality that they showed in the video and the brutality that they've shown to the people underneath them is in fact a sign that they're probably not going to last all that long, because this is what happened to Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They behaved with such brutality that they basically lost the support of the people that they hope to rule.
In the sense that there have been reports that Al-Qaeda and ISIS, to an extent, have been funding their operations through hostage negotiations, trading European hostages for cash, because apparently that is permissible in some nations of Europe. Is the Foley video inclined to show the Europeans that they need to take this seriously and keep paying?
You know, it's really very difficult to say. It is true that people have made hostage taking into a big business, and it does, in fact, serve to provide funding for a number of militant organizations. Before this video, they were in negotiation, not with the U.S. government, with the families, to ask for a very, very large sum of money. So there was an extortion process that was underway. And then I think what happened was with the U.S. strikes in Iraq, they changed their mind and said, okay, we'll make this a political issue rather than a monetary issue. But there's another hostage there, and they obviously are trying to use him as a lever to improve their leverage with the United States.
Can the U.S. government have it both ways in the sense that they insist they do not negotiate with hostages, but they're happy to, you know, turn their heads the other way if the family of a hostage makes an independent deal with ISIS?
I think they do defer to the families. I think they discourage the idea of paying a ransom. But if the family decides to do that, there's probably nothing that they can do about it. And so they would look the other way and probably not make a big deal about it. We had the other case recently of Bo Bergdahl, and the administration, the Obama administration, in fact, did trade some prisoners of al-Qaeda to get him out. So if you like, they did negotiate, and they ended up paying some kind of ransom, not money, but in kind. And Israel does this all the time. They don't recognize Hamas, but they'll deal with Hamas to get their people back. And so this is something that governments have to decide on a real case-by-case basis. There's no hard and fast rule that you can assign to each one of these cases.
If it is the case that European governments routinely pay ransoms, is there blood on their hands in this situation? Would it be better if everybody acted in the same way and didn't negotiate, didn't pay ransoms for hostages?
You know, it's easier said than done. Presidents are grown-ups, and I think they're human. And from my point of view, the president, whether you like it or not, is going to feel free to do whatever he thinks is necessary to get those people out and to save their lives. And frankly, if I were a hostage, I would appreciate that. I think that's probably the right way to go.
Gary Sick is senior research scholar at Columbia University. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and he was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. Gary Sick, thanks as always.
Real pleasure.
We return to the Ebola crisis now. For U.S. aid worker Dr. Kent Brantley, it was a clean bill of health yesterday.
Today is a miraculous day. I'm thrilled to be alive, to be well, and to be reunited with my family.
Brantley was released from Emory Hospital in Atlanta after being evacuated from Liberia after he became infected with Ebola. Nancy Wrightbull, a medical worker also infected, was also released yesterday and declared disease-free. But miraculous days are in short supply back in Liberia, where 576 people are estimated to have been killed by the virus. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has ordered areas of the capital Monrovia quarantined, with the army enforcing confinement in some neighborhoods and curfews. It's a challenge for the government, and joining me now is Lewis Brown, Minister of Information for Liberia. Welcome to the program, Minister Brown.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Would you say your country is in crisis right now?
Oh, we have been for a while. This has rightly been described as an international crisis. The fact that this virus is occurring in densely populated area like Monrovia, where at least one third of the population currently reside, makes it unprecedented and certainly presents a second level of difficulty.
But there's a concern that particularly based on the history of repression in Liberia under previous regimes, that the army doesn't have a lot of credibility and moves into a neighborhood and really people fight back.
Yes, yes, we're quite aware of that. And in some instances, that is why we have used the military as sparingly as we possibly can. And our preference really is for improved community engagement and ownership. Notwithstanding the fact that we now have a rebuilt military that has undergone proper training, guns tend to remind people of the years of wars, something we're hoping our people can move away from. But we have had to make difficult balancing act in ensuring that healthcare workers have the safe corridor they need to provide care to those who need it the most.
Can you put yourself in the mind of a family that's behind an army blockade and feels trapped?
It is difficult. That is why we are moving now with food, with water, and the resources that the government can muster to be able to get it in there. As I speak to you, we're going into a meeting again with the leadership of the entire township, bringing together the cross-sectional interests to be able to provide for them additional wherewithal to ease the pinch that we know our people are feeling. This is why we continue to emphasize it is not just a health hazard, it is not just an economic debilitating instrument, but it is also an attack on our way of life.
Would you say women are most at threat in Liberia from Ebola?
Absolutely. The statistics confirm that. The nature of our family, the way it is structured, women are the caregiver and care providers. And that's part of the difficulty, because how do you say to a mother that you cannot care for your young one, for your own child, when your child is showing signs similar to common treatable ailments such as malaria, diarrhea, which is prevalent at this time of the year? So I understand it. I am doing the best I can. But if I can borrow from Dr. King, no one is healthy in an environment where everyone is sick.
Would you say that ignorance about modern science and the notion that this is a virus is hampering your ability to combat the disease, in that people are responding out of fear and a belief that there's some other cause of Ebola?
Yes, we can say that, but then when we do, we must put it into proper perspective. In our neck of the wood, it is commonplace for us to care for each other. In fact, we consider it a blessing from the divine to be able to return care to those who gave you care when you could not for yourself. So now we're asking people to sort of walk away from these long-held cultural practices and belief. And as people see their loved one die and their loved one infecting them as they were doing what they've always been known, it has now given people a sense of fear. And so we have to work with increased public awareness to be able to deal with the fears.
Finally, is the international community providing as much as you would require here? Do you need more?
We do need more. This is not a fight where less is better. You can't expect a frightened population to remain calm. And so we need to react very quickly so that Liberia does not slip back into instability.
Lewis Brown is Minister of Information for Liberia. Thank you very much, sir, and good luck.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your interest and thank you for your concerns.
He spoke to us from Monrovia, Liberia. As we've noted, of the people infected with Ebola in West Africa, three quarters are women, largely because, as the Minister of Information in Liberia said, the patriarchal structure of West African society puts women in the most direct path as carriers, makes them most vulnerable to infection. Women are overwhelmingly the caregivers, food preparers, nurses, and housekeepers responsible for cleaning and water collection. To explore this more, we turn to Gina Moore, global women's rights reporter for BuzzFeed. She just returned from Liberia a few days ago. Gina Moore, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Hi.
So how does the structure of society in places like Liberia really put women right on the front lines?
You know, it's actually not all that different when you get down to it from the structure of society at home back in the States. Women are on the front lines of caregiving, and I think many of us have seen that in our own houses too. It's formal and it's informal. They're most of the nursing staff in the hospitals and the clinics. They're the people who inside the home are cleaning everything, taking care, making sure sick people get their medicine or whatever the treatment may be. The case with Ebola, though, is that there's no cure, there's no vaccine, there's no real treatment except keeping someone as hydrated as possible. and waiting to see. And in the meantime, as people get sick, they need to be cared for, they need to be cleaned, they need to be attended to, and all that tends to fall on the shoulders of women.
And because the transmission agent of Ebola is bodily fluids or direct contact with the bodies of infected individuals, that's the means by which Ebola is transmitted from patients to women, nurses, and caregivers.
Yeah, that's right. It's actually fairly difficult to catch Ebola if you're not in a caregiving situation or you're not one of the family members who's attending to the burial rites, because it does require direct contact. It passes through bodily fluids. And those who are caring for people, or those who in the past have been burying people as one traditionally might in a normal funeral ceremony, have been highest at risk. The disease also gets more and more contagious as it progresses. So as someone is sick, as someone approaches death, the risk to the caregivers gets higher.
How does this disrupt the structure of society in Liberia? Does it mean women are absent from the homes if they're if they're fatalities, and that puts families and other dependents at risk?
Well, if you imagine the inside of a house, and imagine a family in Liberia as bigger than your average American family. Family in Liberia includes not just the immediate family, father, mother, kids, but also cousins, maybe a grandmother, maybe some aunties. And if one person in that house gets sick, everyone in that house is at risk, because by the time a person is symptomatic, he or she is very contagious. And it's likely going to be all of the women in that house, the wife, the sisters, the aunties, the daughters, who are taking care of the sick person. And they, if they're doing this without protective equipment, which most of them are in Liberian homes, they're at risk for getting sick as well. So you can begin to imagine the ripple effect that this will have just in a family, in one house, to say nothing of house to house to house to house in a small community. But there's also something else I think is really important in terms of how this disrupts society. The only way to protect yourself from getting Ebola when you're encountering a sick patient is not to touch them. And in Liberia, just like at home, the language of love and compassion for the people who are sick is human touch. And it's really, really difficult to look at someone you love and not be able to touch them in a time of need. And that's a real spiritual disruption.
And it's something universal that I think everyone can imagine. Is education and the distribution of countermeasures, you know, sterilization equipment, protection for hands and masks and the like, a solution here?
Certainly. There is protective equipment that can be distributed to healthcare workers, and we need a lot more of that to move a lot more quickly. Latex gloves are a huge need in Liberia right now for doctors and nurses who are on the front lines of care. But no one is planning to issue latex gloves to all of the mothers of Liberia. And so there will always be some private risk inside the home until the disease is under control and eventually dies down. But all the indications are that that's going to take quite a long time.
If women are the caregivers and also the predominant majority of those infected, who's caring for the women?
It's a good question. It's other women, I think, although you can also find really, really tragic stories where the answer is no one. I met a 61-year-old man in West Point, which is an informal neighborhood in Liberia that was in the news last week because the community had been uncomfortable with a clinic there and had attacked it, closed this Ebola holding center, and now the community is under quarantine to control the spread of the disease. It's densely packed so the disease can move quickly. The 61-year-old man I met there before the quarantine was put into place told me that his brother had died of Ebola and that he had passed it to his wife. They had three children, but the children were saved because they're living with another relative somewhere else in the country. And I asked him how the wife had gotten Ebola. And he said, well, she took care of my brother. And then I asked him who took care of her. And he said, no one. Everyone was too afraid.
Finally, Gina, NGOs suspect that it will take 6 months or more to get Ebola under control in these areas. Do you see a permanent disruption to the structure of society in the places you visited?
Certainly, that's a sort of terrifying window to a lot of the people who are working on the response. That's a really long time, and there's so much need right now for equipment and help. But it's important to remember that even though this is a fairly contagious disease, it's also very rare. There are 4 million people living in Liberia, and there are about 1,200 cases that have been reported as of the newest numbers from the World Health Organization. So it's certainly risky. It can spread very quickly. But right now, we're still thankfully talking about a small portion of the population. I think the bigger effects are going to be from the fear and suspicion and distrust this creates between neighbors and friends, and that sort of spiritual rift we were talking about when you can't care for the loved ones who are dying.
Gina Moore is global human rights reporter for BuzzFeed. She just returned from Liberia, spoke with us from London. Thanks so much, Gina.
Thank you.
Good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Friday, summer winding down. It's a Movie Friday with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Happy Friday, John.
Is this a good weekend or a bad weekend? We got three different things, really.
Yeah, it's a little so-so this weekend.
Well, let's start with the Sin City. We get to see Rodriguez and Brolin and Rourke.
That's
all three together. Let's hear a clip.
You have trespassed on hallowed ground.
You're the slug that hurt my friend, huh?
Shall we?
Mostly the green screen stars in this movie. What'd you think?
Yeah, well, it's a Robert Rodriguez movie. That's Mickey Rourke and Xander Berkeley going mano a mano. I was a big fan of the first Sin City. I liked that. I thought it had a great live-action comic book look to it. This one's got the same look. The visuals are beautiful, very stylish and fun. It's a little jumbled, and it doesn't have quite that kind of wacky, unhinged, violent quality that the first film had that I liked so much.
The subtitle is A Dame to Kill For. Who's the dame here?
That's Eva Green, the great Eva Green from Dark Shadows and from 300 Rise of an Empire, who I think is wonderful, and she's terrific in this movie.
But doesn't quite work.
Not overall.
All right, When the Game Stands Tall, let's hear.
Bellevue played better than us, and we lost a high school football game. That's football. But it's not you. Don't let a game define who you are. Let the way you live your lives do that.
Boy, the soundtrack sounds cliche. What do you think?
A lot of this is cliche. This follows the De La Salle California football team, which had a winning streak of 151 games from the early 1990s to the early 2000s, and what happens when that streak ends and how they get back on their feet, how they stay together as a team, and actually how they just keep playing football, which is the big problem for me with this movie. It doesn't seem like a lot happens after that streak ends. They just keep playing football and hearing speeches and giving speeches and playing football, and then there's more speeches, and it didn't really do it for me.
What I liked about this movie were the messages in it. It's based on a true story. The coach, Bob Ledesour, played by Jim Caviezel from Passion of the Christ, really did try to instill really valuable lessons in these kids. I just think the movie's got such a stern, earnest, dour kind of finger-wagging tone to it that eventually you feel like a kid in a classroom being lectured, and you start to tune out after a while.
Two near misses out of three. If I Stay might be the big release of the weekend. Let's hear.
I'll do whatever you want. Just please stay. You're my home, Mia. I don't care where we are. I just care that we're together. I know that now. I will do anything if you stay.
Well, you can hear the beep in the background and kind of figure out what's going on there. R.J. Cutler directs this first feature. What do you think, Rafer?
Well, it's based on a young adult novel, and it's got young adult written all over it. Chloe Grace Moretz plays Mia. She's the character doing the beeping there.
But she has a big role in the film.
She does, of course, have a big role. She's really the main star of the film. What I liked as a parent is that the parent characters in this movie are kind of real. They're a couple of old 90s rockers like myself and trying to raise a kid in the world. So I found something to to grab onto there, but I'm not a 12-year-old girl, and the rest of the movie left me a little cold.
I really think that the girls out there who are between like 10 and 17 are going to love this. They're going to watch it. They're going to cry. They're going to say insecure things to a boy, and the boy's going to say just the right thing back in their fantasies, and they're going to see that happen on the big screen. And for them, I'd say, go out and see this movie. There's nothing wrong with it. It's decent. It doesn't have any bad messages. But I would say for anybody who's not in that demographic, you might feel a little bit like this is schlocky. You might be rolling your eyes. You might think, this is not for me, but bring your girls to it.
I think you nailed it. I saw it with my 13-year-old, and you got that right. Kristen, what about the podcast? What about the podcast?
This week we have Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen joining us. Yeah, sports writer, culture writer. He's going to be talking with us about When the Game Stands Tall from a sports writer and former athlete perspective.
That's great. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, and co-host of the podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks,
you
John.
Too,
you too.
Writer and director Matthew Weiner loves the early 60s before they turned Woodstock hippie. For Weiner, the 60s was an era of martinis at five, restless housewives, and flannel-suited husbands who were confident American masters of the universe, like Mad Men star Don Draper.
First job, I was in-house at a fur company with this old pro copywriter, Greek, named Teddy. And Teddy told me the most important idea in advertising is new. But he also talked about a deeper bond with the product. Nostalgia.
Nostalgia, in all of its forms, interests Weiner. His newest project is a comedy about the personal nostalgia of two friends stuck in an adulthood of cheap feelings and a fear of approaching middle age.
I don't want money.
You don't have to put such a shitty spin on everything. Maybe this is your father's way of giving you a chance to be what you always wanted to be.
This is my father reaching from beyond the grave to control me. The whole thing just insinuates that I'm crazy, that there's something wrong with the way that I live, but I'm fine. Everything's fine.
I'm supporting you. Of course everything's fine. Look, I'm the last person that should be saying this. But what about me?
That's Owen Wilson and Zach Galifianakis, stars of the new movie Are You Here? It's a story of how a sudden inheritance forces two childhood friends to think about what is really meaningful in their lives. Weiner wrote the movie for Wilson, but it's a story about friendships from his own life.
I had this realization that, you know, I'd gotten married and my wife is my best friend, but so many of the people who were so important to me, especially my childhood friendships, they just disappeared. I had no male friends. And I was like, well, what happened? And it happens to a lot of people. And I think it's something that's kind of revered in the movies, and it's maybe it's a wish fulfillment. And that was sort of the first line I had in the movie, was this idea that friendship is rarer than love because there's nothing in it for anybody.
And to get there, you really have to explore this territory of being lost as a man. I mean, that's sort of
– yeah. I mean, that was a great thing about having these two main characters. They're kind of two halves of anyone's personality. They're extremes, as they should be. But I wanted to write about someone who was unable to feel. Not that you can't feel, but you don't want to. It's just too overwhelming. And I think a lot of our life right now is devoted towards some form of anesthetization, some sort of medication, whether it's – for this character, it's literally drugs and alcohol and women. That's Owen's character. And then Zach Galifianakis' character is, you know, mentally ill. He's feeling too much. It's too extreme. At the same time, life is coming towards them, and they basically have to face the compromises of growing up. And is it a compromise to grow up, or is it just an admission of the truth? Is it a way to get to real feelings?
Looking at your career, you know, when Mad Men came about, I don't think anyone in American culture looked back at that period in the 1960s as some sort of marker. And now it's territory that everybody knows about, and, you know, it's as unmistakable as Woodstock.
It's weird. I wrote the pilot 14 years ago. It took 7 years to get it on the air from when I wrote it. And trying to explain to people even what this period was, they knew what the 50s was, and they knew what Woodstock was, and they didn't understand there was anything in between, which is funny because to me it was – I kept trying to explain to them like what a unique moment it was. And all I found is the more that I investigated the period, 1959 and 1960 in particular, where I started, New York is the center of the universe. Mm-hmm. It is the height of America's influence, of America's goodwill. They were reaping the benefits of the Marshall Plan, you know, 15 years later, Center Publishing, finance, television, everything. And there is this feeling, I think, that this is the way the world is going to be. And then it just kind of doesn't. It seems to almost be like, I mean, it might have turned back that way by the time it got to 1985. But I was just surprised at its lack of interest.
It's almost as though the following of the show related to some sense that this was a perfect moment. From that sensibility in America came our sort of finest hour of the 20th century after World War II.
The irony of it is that it was meant as a kind of revision of history to basically say, like, whatever your interpretation of the 50s is, you think it's Leave It to Beaver. People were laughing at Leave It to Beaver then. America's a subversive country. The number one bestseller is Catch 22. This is, you know, we are a self-questioning, self-critical culture. And part of the difficulty of getting the show on the air was they said, well, no one's going to be interested in America and no one's going to be interested in this period outside of America. And it turned out that whatever influence our culture has had in the most positive sense, style and so forth, people remembered it. And it's not just the wish fulfillment of like, let's go back to a time of unprotected sex and steak and whiskey and, you know, smoking without consequences. They were aware of a great many of these things. I think the show has other appeals outside of history, but I think that there is something about the American character in there because it kind of started off I had this fantasy of doing this indictment, you know, of like right. What was decayed about America and what was wrong with it. And I don't know what happened, but I just said, you know what? There is social, cultural, financial mobility in the United States. And we are extremely forgiving of self-fiction. We celebrate people. Sometimes they're criminals even who make up who they are. And you can, I lived on the street where I saw this guy come from Cambodia, open a donut store. I lived there for 8 years. I watched him go from sleeping in the store to having his kids run the store to having his kids go to college to not being open 24 hours anymore, unfortunately, for the donut buyers. And I just was thinking like, you know, that has not changed. And everything you can say about race and all of the issues that face this country, it's still – we have a black president in this country. There is something very – I don't know if it's just like we're mobile. You know, we're adaptable and we're accepting of change in some weird way. Some of us are.
Is TV where it's at right now? I mean, Soderbergh would say that. Other directors, it's just a place that has a bigger canvas.
I think that as – the motion picture industry has become more global and more of a silent movie kind of situation without language. It's a different kind of entertainment that to do something specific and related to the culture, you have to be on television. Is that good or bad? I don't know. You know, Steven Soderbergh made Ocean's 11, 12 and 13. You know what I mean? He's
right.
Benefited greatly from that and made some great movies as well. I can tell you that as it becomes more and more lucrative, there will be more and more interference. And I feel very lucky that I got to sort of get in there between The Sopranos and everything else when everyone on a new channel on AMC where they were completely willing to take a chance. But as the stakes become higher, I think that it has a chance of sort of being watered down and ruined like everything else. But I've gotten to be there and, you know, I think everything's going to be watched on the same screen eventually anyway. And you can watch everything that was ever made. You know, my kids don't know that Netflix is on the internet. It comes on the TV. And, you know, we watch Columbo. And I did not find it for them. One of them's born in 2001.
Yeah.
So the television is a mysterious thing. I think it's nice that they've gotten bigger and the sound's better in the house. But to me, it's still like, are you writing a novel? Is it a short story? Is it a play? It's a form. And there's something great about the continuing storyline. And there's something great about visiting with the characters every week. But then you see people are watching them all in one night. So it's such a new world that I can't really weigh in on it. All I can say is that there's just things that you can only do on TV. So if that's your business, that's the place to go.
Matthew Weiner, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
Matthew Weiner is the director and writer of the new film, Are You Here? It opens in theaters in limited release today. We'll also have a longer version of our interview with Matthew Weiner available on our Takeaway Weekender podcast. Head over to iTunes to subscribe to the Takeaway Daily podcast. And if you sign up, you'll also get a special episode delivered to you every Saturday. We feature some of our favorite conversations from the week, pull back the curtain on how The Takeaway comes together every day. That's an exciting, kind of scary story. Visit us at thetakeaway.org to find out more. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Have a great weekend. This is The Takeaway.